Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Philbrook Museum is currently featuring an exhibition which provides a cultural introduction to the arts and crafts of the Islamic world. Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place offers viewers an entree into the centrality of the religion in the everyday cultural life of its adherents. And over time, that life has been far and wide, from West and North Africa to Spain and Southeastern Europe, across the Middle East, Central and Southern Asia, even the islands of the Far East. Drawn from the collection of the Newark Museum, Wondrous Worlds features over 150 objects from over 1,200 years in expressions ranging from calligraphy, textiles and ornamentation, architecture, the culture of hospitality, and cross-cultural exchange. There's also a local element to these objects as community voices within Oklahoma's Muslim community share their stories of how their own lives intersect with the objects on display. And throughout the exhibition, there'll be special programming that highlights these connections. My guest today is the local curator of the exhibition, Susan Green, the Associate Curator for Special Collections, Archives, and Research at Philbrook. Wondrous Worlds is on display at the main campus through October 6th, and she joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Susan Green, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich. I'm so pleased to be here.
And congratulations on this new exhibit, Wondrous World. So what was the impetus for this exhibit at this particular time for Philbrook?
We are so honored to have this exhibition and so honored to be able to allow our audience to have the opportunity to see these objects and explore these ideas. We were so lucky to work with the Newark Museum. It is a traveling exhibition, so it's been to a couple of other venues and is ending its travel in Tulsa at the moment. So the Newark Museum has this rich, deep collection of Islamic art. And we can, in the exhibition, we can explore artwork from over 1,200 years, from around the 10th century, 9th, 10th century to 2016. We can explore artwork from Burkina Faso to Indonesia, from China to Turkey, to Spain, to France, to America, the United States. And so we get a really deep and broad exploration of Islamic art.
Yeah. Now, this Newark collection, I guess Islamic art is a particular focus of this particular museum.
The Newark Museum has a broad collection just in general, so this is one of their areas. And because it's such an excellent collection, they were able to make a really robust exhibition that could then travel.
And this exhibition seems to be almost like a cultural primer in many ways. It's a sort of an introduction to people who don't know Islam from except perhaps what they hear in the news. And the objects that are used as a part of cultural traditions as well as somewhat religious practice as well.
Absolutely. In fact, we start out with an introduction of Islam. We knew that if you were to explore artwork that reflects Islam, you really need to have this understanding of Islam. And there are so many misconceptions about Islam in this particular time period. And so we start out with the five pillars. And in Islam, there are these foundational beliefs. And those beliefs are the five pillars. So that declaration of faith, that there is one God. It is a monotheistic faith that's directly related to Judaism and Christianity. So Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are all Abrahamic faiths, all stem from Abraham. Then the pillar of prayer, that one should pray five times a day. The pillar of charity, that one should give to the needy to help support your community. The pillar of fasting for Ramadan, that you should fast so that you can consider those who are less fortunate and really focus your energy, reset your beliefs, and start anew. And then also the pillar of
pilgrimage.
The Hajj, which a lot of people are familiar with. So many of those are so common to beliefs across our history.
And in this first room, you have a number of objects that relate to each one of those five pillars. For example, there is astrolabe from Egypt. It's used to help a Muslim, wherever he is, locate Mecca for the purpose of prayers.
Absolutely. So if you need to pray five times a day, you need to know what time of day it is so that you're praying at the right moment. And you also, because in Islam you pray towards Mecca, where the Kaaba is, the big black cube that we're familiar with from images, We're told that we need to pray towards Kaaba or in Mecca. So you need to know the direction. And the astrolabe was essentially a really early computer. It had, it's so complicated and so beautiful. There's different plates. And you hold up this instrument and you find from a set point, you find a star or the sun. So you have an angle. And the angle helps tell you what time of day. You have a plate according to a latitude, so you can determine where you are in space. It is the coolest little tiny computer. And the best place to learn how to use an astrolabe is YouTube. It is glorious that you can find the heights of buildings, distances, and astrolabes were used commonly in navigation. Yeah, right. So on ships and on the sea, and it also happens to be really useful to find the time of day and the location of Mecca.
This object is something you'll see throughout the exhibit is, again, all this beautiful design work that is a part of Islamic art, and this is part of the astrolabe, and every object in this first room, which range from a princely crown from Indonesia, right, one which designates that the wearer had been on a Hajj, bowls and jars used in Morocco at the time of breaking fast.
Yes.
Were they actually ceremonial objects?
No, they're used. And that's one of the glorious things about those objects and so many of the objects in the exhibition is that they truly were used and valued. And we know that those jars, the jubana, that they held a soup. So if you're breaking your fast, so you have to fast from right before dawn until right after dusk. And you break your fast traditionally with maybe dates or nuts, something small, or a thin soup. You don't want to break your fast with something really rich like a lasagna, you know, cheesy, thick lasagna. You want to have something light. And so you'd have this light, wonderful soup called harira in Morocco. And the harira is traditionally stored in these jars, but the jars also were used to make cheese and maybe butter. And so when we unpacked the objects, and these jars are from the 1800s to about 1900, 1910 or so. So over 100, 200 years old. And when we opened up the case, you could smell the aroma of dairy. So they were still, you knew these objects were used. They were used and valued and kept until they went into the Newark collection.
Now, there are two panels that open up into the second room. These are, and I'm going to maybe mess up the name, but it's Kayamaya panels used for celebration. These are beautiful, vibrant colors. And again, you see the motifs that are sort of common to Islamic depictions, design
the patterning,
motifs.
Yeah, yes.
Patterning.
They are truly glorious objects. They are 12 or 14 feet tall and wide, and they are tent panels from Egypt. They have vibrant colors, the patterning, they have inscriptions across the top. And so this first room that helps us understand the foundation of Islam is small and is this really deep blue. And we wanted a way to open up into the rest of the exhibition, to open up to all of the ways that artists who are inspired by their faith explore their faith and explore ways to create objects for use. And so we, on either side of this entryway, we hung these beautiful, glorious tent panels. And the inscriptions at the top, one of them says something like, and I'm paraphrasing, but something like, all herein have attained their desires, and patience is the key to relief. So these wonderful sentiments of joy and calmness as you walk into the space.
Oh. Now, the exhibit is divided into five different themes. Would you tell us about the themes?
Sure. There are five. So we didn't divide it by geographical region or chronologically because we wanted to think about the way artists are inspired by their faith. So these ideas, and the ideas are common across faiths. So there are the art of writing. And in Islam in particular, calligraphy is the highest form of art because to write the Quran, you're writing Arabic. The way one learns and writes Arabic, whether it's poetry or whether it's scripture.
That's really a medieval idea. When you think about it, think about, you know, one of the highest callings prior to the printing press was a monk who would devote his life to translating the Bible or, you know, the Torah in Judaism.
And in Buddhism as well, the idea of writing and that meditative act so that you're expressing sentiments as well as aesthetic imagery, as well as the poems or verses that you're writing. So there's the how one transcribes these words to make beautiful images that both convey an idea in the words themselves, but also show pattern or show images. And then there's the section International Exchange. So it explores how Islam is not, I think there's a misconception that if you think of Islam or Muslims, you think of North Africa or the Middle East, and that's not the case. Islam is the second largest religion in the world currently, and within 20 or 50 years after Muhammad's death, had spread thousands of miles across Asia.
That's right, from Spain to the other side of India.
Exactly. Yeah. So International Exchange, it's the exchange of artistic ideas, the exchange of materials back and forth, the exchange of innovations and inventions. And so you see artists from China being inspired by artists in the Middle East who then inspire artists in the United States. So it's this wonderful interplay. And then in the center, we have a section about hospitality. So how one would set the stage to be as hospitable, gracious, and kind to guests as possible. So it has music and food and dancing and conversation as themes. And then there's the section of faith and fashion. So how one shows their faith through either the clothing or the ornamentation, the jewelry that you would wear. And then also how faith, the last section is architecture. So how one shows faith in the buildings and the way we surround ourselves in our spaces.
My guest today is Susan Green, the Associate Curator for Special Collections, Archives, and Research at the Philbrook Museum. And Philbrook presents Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place. It's now on display at the main museum near Brookside through October 6th. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. As you go into that first area, you see this mix of traditional items along with artists reinventing a few artists. I would say most of it's artifacts and objects of use as opposed to objects for just aesthetic art.
Absolutely.
But there is, at the very beginning of that first area, you see some prayer books, which is a traditional way in which you learn verses from the Quran. And then Victor Ekput, I believe, a Nigerian artist, takes those prayer boards and then changes them into this unique piece of contemporary art.
Absolutely. He is a wonderful artist living and working today in Washington, D.C. And so he's taken this traditional form of the prayer board, almost like a blackboard. You would hold this board and you could write and learn how to write Arabic, memorize your verses, and then you could wash it away or scrape it away and start over. So this traditional form, and he has created these beautiful sculptures that hang on the wall that show the letter forms, but he's taking Arabic, he's taking a traditional language in Africa, he's taking made-up ideas and symbols, and he's putting them all together, and he's created his own poem that talks about the sun and it talks about the moon.
Should the moon meet us apart, may the sun find us together.
Exactly. So beautiful. So yeah. Beautiful.
Textiles play a big role in this exhibition. You see that right off the front with some Moroccan textiles, a man's robe, and a woman's woven belt. And then next to it, a piece of art by Frederick Arthur Bridgman, who is an Orientalist. He loved the idea of Middle Eastern culture. And you see a painting from 1883 that sort of gives you a sense of these two objects as they would have been seen in the late 19th century.
Exactly. So the Moroccan robe is richly woven with gold threads on a dark background. And then the belt is actually one of my very favorite objects. It's a belt that is quite long, 11 feet long. So you think about how many times it would have to wrap around a woman's waist, but it has four different patterns. So two different colorways and then two different textures, almost ways that the colors are woven together. So a woman could choose which pattern she wanted to show that day, and she could fold it in a certain way and wrap it around her waist to show that certain pattern. And because of the complications of the belt, it's hard to imagine that on a woman. And so we're able to use the Bridgman painting as an illustration of how that robe and the belt would have looked together.
That area of international exchange, when I was first looking at these objects, I saw some Chinese ceramics, a Ming Dynasty jar, a pear-shaped vase.
Which is beautiful, yes.
Yeah, and I was going, why are these here? And then eventually it becomes apparent to me that it's like these were part of these trade routes that went from the Middle East to China, And you can see the influence on both cultures.
Absolutely. There's these wonderful examples of Chinese vessels, either in the Tang or Qing dynasties, and they had traveled to the Middle East on these trade routes, which in school we learned is the Silk Road. So these trade routes, they go to the Middle East. They see the beautiful forms that Middle Eastern artists are making out of metal, because that was a form that you could take and travel back. It was easy to transport back to China. So they take these metal forms, ewers and plates and bowls and little cups, and they take them back to China. And their ceramic artists are enthralled with these shapes. So the Chinese ceramic artists create ceramic vessels in those same shapes, which were originally metal. Then they, because of the trade routes, they take these now ceramic shapes, often in blue and white or in three-color splat, almost a splatter glaze. They take them back to the Middle East, where the artists are so inspired by the glaze forms that then they experiment. So the Chinese artists are working in porcelain with cobalt glazes. And so the Middle Eastern artists are inspired by the forms and the colors and the patterning that the ceramic artists in China have used. And they create their own wares. And so we have a display that shows vases and ewers from China using Middle Eastern forms as inspiration. And then Middle Eastern artists have created these beautiful plates and dishes using inspiration from China for the decorations. Yeah. But then it doesn't stop there, because it's even more, it inspires artists further down the road. At some point, especially the ewer, if you look at the little ewer, it has a silver top. And the silver top, the original top to the ewer, probably got broken. If you were imagining, you could imagine the top was lost or broken.
It's like, for those who don't know what a ewer is, it's basically
a pitcher.
A pitcher, yeah.
A pitcher with a little top.
With a stem to pour out a liquid, oil or water.
Exactly. So this pitcher has a top that's silver and not porcelain. And so you can imagine that at some point the top, the lid, got broken or lost. And whoever owned it at that point was in the United States and wanted to replace that top. And so where did they take it? They took it to Tiffany's. And this was in the early 20th century. And so Tiffany's made a little new top to it. And so you see the Middle Eastern artists inspired the Chinese artists. In China, they inspired the Middle Eastern artists. And then it comes full circle in the United States.
Wow. You mentioned the hospitality section, and you have actually sort of a courtyard installation of what would be typical of North Africa. I guess to give viewers a sense of what that scene would be like. We've seen plenty of Orientalist paintings from the 19th century that sort of give us a sense of that, but you wanted to create it as an installation.
As an installation, we had the flexibility to do that. There's not a lot of opportunities when you're looking at museum objects to place objects on top of each other. So in this case, we can put tables and cushions and a coffee set on top of a rug with a screen right there. And the objects are primarily from Algeria, an object from Morocco, and a screen from Spain. So all from the same area and about the same time period. So if we're thinking about how one sets the stage for being as hospitable and gracious as possible, what would it be like? You would sit on the cushions, you would visit, you would play music, you would drink coffee. And it's hard to imagine in a white box. So our exhibition crew also found a photograph from 1899 that shows a specific courtyard in Algiers. And we recreated those horseshoe arches and tile work so that you get an even better sense of what it would be like in this space.
As I mentioned, a lot of these are functional objects for the most part, or ceremonial functional objects, like there's daggers and sheaths, and these
they're
were
so
not
cool.
used, but they were show importance and status.
Ceremonial, yes.
And status, a lot of these objects. But there is some beautiful art too, and one of the things was this Indian paper art from anywhere in the 16th to 18th century. These are exquisite little pieces
tiny
of
paintings.
Art.
Yeah, small
Tell
paintings.
Tell us about these.
So we have some from India and a few from Persia as well, Iran, and they primarily tell stories. So there's this wonderful story of the warrior, a warrior who he keeps falling asleep and his horse keeps saving him. So we have two images, Roskin Rustum. And then we also have some images of essentially party scenes for our hospitality section, what it would look like in India to have food set before you, dancing, music, the instruments that people would play. And then in our fashion section that show clothing and jewelry, we have three beautiful paintings from India from the Mughal era that show wealthy individuals and the clothes that they would have worn. And the detail on the clothing, the jewelry, the head ornamentation is just glorious. It's beautiful. And the detail in the paintings themselves, the color, and you just want to step into the paintings.
In the case of this Indian paper art, what's also really interesting is that, yes, the image itself is very interesting, but I assume this has come out of a manuscript at some point. And so there's this very elaborate border that is included in the image, which I think is really gives you sort of a context of how somebody would have viewed it, where the border is as much care is taken in that as it is in the image itself.
Absolutely. So one is an image of Bahram Shah, who was a ruler, and he's throwing a party. He has a celebration before him. And in the border is a golden scene of boars and stags and a tiger. And so you imagine that this feast happened after a successful hunt.
Yeah, and very important. It's,
yes,
you know, it's again
the
status.
Context. Yeah. And status. And it's gold paint. So again, the wealthy.
The area of art, the art of calligraphy, the art of writing, mm-hmm. is also really interesting. It shows a number of like book covers, pen stands, inkwells. And also I should mention in the very first room, there's a beautiful hand-inscribed Quran, again, showing the importance of calligraphy.
Yes.
But I also want to mention something else that shows up throughout the exhibit, but I noticed it in this particular section, was a series of community stories. I assume this was part of the preparation for this exhibit,
yes.
where you talk to people throughout the community about what these objects meant to them.
Yes.
And again, you got some wonderful stories from the community.
We are so lucky that we did. And one of the things that was incredibly important to us was to show the objects in a respectful way and to understand our community. And also to make as many connections as we could. And so we've started out with a few, and we're hoping that as our visitors come and see the exhibition, more people will be inspired. But wonderful stories of, for example, a book stand that one of our community partners, our friends, it reminded her of her grandmother's book stand and the time and prayers that her grandmother gave the book stand. So a Quran shouldn't lay flat on a prosaic table. It should be elevated. And the book stand that's in our exhibition is beautiful mother of pearl and inlaid. And so you would have this almost X-shaped stand that you could place your Quran in. And so our dear friend was able to tell the story of her grandmother reading the Quran. Or another one of our community friends told us about her grandfather playing game board and getting all the kids and uncles and aunts into the back room and playing game board. And we have a similar game board in the exhibition. And it helps, we hope that it will help as our visitors who may not be Muslim or may not be from North Africa, the Middle East, or the Islamic world, if they read the stories, while they may not be familiar with a book stand, they may remember their grandmother reading whatever holy text they grew up with, the Bible, the Torah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you can remember those things and we can bring connections. We can bring our community together.
There are a number of contemporary pieces, especially in the last section, which I'd want to mention before mm-hmm. we run out of time. And that is a one by Leila Essaidi, a Moroccan photographer. It's a gorgeous image of the interior of a palace in Morocco.
Yes.
And I guess it was actually a harem room?
It was. And so this is such a striking, gorgeous image. It's in three separate panels. And she has shown us the interior of a harem. So a harem is a space traditionally for women and children. It is such a complicated space and a complicated image that she's presented to us from stories of women who have grown up or lived in harem spaces. They talk about the community that they have together. Their relatives, their friends, their children are all together. So it's a very supportive space. But of course, there's a lot of complexities there. Non-family member males can't enter. Depending on the family and the culture, you may or may not be able to leave without an escort. You may need to cover. So it's very complicated. And Leila Essaidi has shown us this gorgeous space. It's saturated with color. It's saturated with patterning, which is so important in Islamic art. And once you look closer, you realize, because you want to be in that space to look around all of the columns and the corners. But once you look closer, you realize that there's a woman in the middle. in this alcove, and she's in a traditional pose in Western art. And so yes. The Orientalist artists from Europe and America went to North Africa and the Middle East, and they showed these women in sort of sensual poses, the odalisques in the harem. And they showed women without agency. They sexualized them and objectified them. And so Lala Asaidi, as a Moroccan-American artist, is taking that and exploring those ideas.
Sort of reclaiming it.
Reclaiming it a little bit. And this woman is in this beautiful space, but she doesn't have anyone with her. She's all alone. It is this gorgeous architectural space, but there's no doors. She is there, and she's looking directly at us, but she begins to recede into the architecture. Her face is actually painted with the pattern of the tiles. So she is being consumed or subsumed into the architecture. So does she have agency? Is she part of the architecture? Is she her own human being?
It's a beautiful object.
It is so beautiful.
And that is right next to another contemporary by Afruz Amigi. It's called The Offering. And this is an amazing sculpture featuring, it's aluminum sculpture with tiny, tiny little chains. And it's made into Islamic architectural elements. You see turrets and minarets that you would see around a mosque, yet done in this very contemporary fashion.
It is there. They hang from the ceiling, so they're suspended. There's three of them in varying sizes, and they are so lightweight. They weigh about what a cat would weigh, 5 to 10 pounds, very lightweight. But they take up such space. And because they're these aluminum chains, they reflect light. So they're so reflective and kind of glow in the space.
But they're creating patterns on the wall, too.
Yes, they're creating those patterns. They're throwing these shadows. And so one thing she says is how she was in, so she grew up in Tehran, but her family had to emigrate during the 80s and the destruction of Tehran. And she was inspired by the shapes of the minarets that she saw around her growing up. These shapes that stretch up to the sky and almost give prayers to the sky. And at the same time, she's inspired by the shapes that came from the sky, the missiles and the bombs that came during the bombing of Tehran.
During the Iran-Iraq War.
Exactly. Yep. So this play of light and shadow, of prayers going to heaven and the destruction of the people and the community of Tehran. So it's both Lala Asaidi's and Afruz Amigi's pieces are so important, and they hopefully will help us understand the complexity of Islamic art.
Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place is now on display at Philbrook through October 6th. There'll be programming throughout the exhibit, which you can find at philbrook.org.
Absolutely.
And it is really an interesting exhibit. When I was visiting, I saw several families that were, this was not new to them, but they were, I think there was a sense of pride in seeing this culture reflected here in a Tulsa museum. It's good that you're sharing this with a wider audience.
Absolutely. We hope we have wonderful conversations that come out of the exhibition, that we are connecting people, and that people will see the objects in new ways.
Susan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Susan Green is the Associate Curator for Special Collections, Archives, and Research at Philbrook Museum of Art. Philbrook presents Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place, now on display at the museum through October 6th. For information, visit philbrook.org. Philbrook will be closed on July 4th. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.